Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Gardening expert and UPR friend Dan Drost is joining us today to answer your questions. Whether you've got a large backyard garden, participate in a community garden, or have a small box near your window, Dan can help. You can get your question to us right now to upraccess@gmail.com, or you can call us during the hour, 800-826-1495. Dan Drost is an emeritus professor of horticulture and extension vegetable specialist in the Department of Plant, Soils, and Climate at Utah State University. He's also a longtime contributor to UPR, giving us gardening advice on segments such as the Green Thumb. Hope you join us following the news. Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams, and today we have gardening expert and UPR friend Dan Drost. He's going to join us to answer your questions. Before we do that, some unfinished business from a few days ago. I apologize, I didn't see this email, so this is a little bit later than I had announced, but we had a nonprofit spotlight and had several nonprofits call in and tout their services, and I got this one. That I want to get on here right now. This email is from Lindsay Harrelson. She says she's the executive director of the William A. Bernard Warming Center, where it is our mission to serve homeless, unhoused individuals and families. It has been brought to my attention by City Council Member Abby Anderson that you acknowledge folks doing good work during your morning radio show, which we certainly did. I want to acknowledge all the stakeholders who have served with the Warming Center to best support a vulnerable population in the Bear River region. Thank you to all of the volunteers, staff, and board members who worked tirelessly this past winter to serve 148 unique unhoused guests and offer 2,155 nights of shelter with safety, care, and dignity. Thank you to the founders of the Warming Center who did the footwork and heavy lifting to open the center that runs on best practices and evidence-based approaches. Thank you to Cache Valley community that advocates the need for a shelter and supports us with very much needed donations. Finally, thank you to the Congregation of St. John's Episcopal Church in Logan for housing the WB Warming Center, and as always, without hesitation, supporting our additional needs as we continue to grow. And so that is Lindsay Harrelson, who is executive director of the William A. Bernard Warming Center, which I think had its second year this last winter, and we'll have its third year coming up. I'm imagining it'll open in November-ish when the weather starts to get brisk again. So thanks for that, Lindsay, and sorry I missed that. I just wanted to get that on. Dan Drost is with us. Whether you got a large backyard or participate in a community garden or have a small box near your window, Dan can help you. You can get your question to us right now, gardening question, to at upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com, or you can call us to 800-826-1495, 800-826-1495. Dan is Emeritus Professor of Horticulture and Extension Vegetable Specialist in the Department of Plant, Soils, and Climate at Utah State University, also a longtime contributor to UPR, and he's given us longtime gardening advice on segments such as the Green Thumb and now on Access Utah. Dan, thanks so much for coming in.
Well, it's my pleasure, Tom. It's always good to come in and chat with you and visit my old haunts and that type of thing. And you know, believe me, retirement is everything they say it is. It's quite enjoyable to know that you can get up in the morning when you want and go to bed at night when you want and not have to think about everything that's going to go on in the next day.
Yeah. Well, congratulations.
So a pitch for retirement.
Yes, for sure. Well, Friend Weller just took you up on that.
He did the same, and you know, I'll have to run him down sometime and find out what he's doing.
You told me before we went on the air, I'd like you to tell people about this briefly. You interrupted retirement briefly here and went to Australia.
It's you know, one of those things that kind of come up. You know, people are always looking for experts to come and talk about different things, and I've had, you know, 35 or so years of working with both the Utah onion industry and the national onion industry here. And I got a call from a colleague in Australia, and they were looking for somebody to come and speak with their industry about issues that were pertinent to them, as well as things that were going on here in the States, because, you know, it's a long ways between places and they don't always get a full assessment of what we are doing in the country. So I went to Australia for 2 weeks to kind of consult with the onion industry. And so we traveled around to South Australia, to Victoria, down to Tasmania, which is the primary onion production region. And they're in the middle of the winter there, or they're going into the equivalent of December weather. And so it's a good time for them. And they also have educational meetings. And so I spoke at a conference and basically shared my experiences, and then related things that we were doing, how it impacts them. And it's always interesting when you go places like that to see the similarities. There's hardly any dissimilarity. That's the interesting thing. I think people around the world think that there's differences where they are. And the main differences are climatic in some ways. But onions are growing across the globe in all kinds of environments. And so basically you got to know how an onion grows. And if you know how the onion grows, then you can adapt it to wherever. And so we discussed all of those types of things, as well as shared research and outreach efforts that we're doing here in the United States that I would say is blessed with the land grant system, which a Utah State University is part of. And that land grant system has individuals that help the farmers of their communities to be successful. And by far, ag in the United States is very successful because of our land grant system.
How cold does it get in their winter? How cold was it?
Well, actually, if you're in Melbourne or in Adelaide, or, we were in a Devonport area, which is by Hobart, they're at sea level. So,
yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, the days were, 55, 60. The nights were, down to about the freezing point. You know, they were complaining about the fact that it's cold. Well, it's cold and humid. That's why it's cold to me. Yeah. But I actually thought it was like, it was sweater weather. You know, it was pretty nice. I just remember living in New Zealand. It was kind of like that, when you're at sea level. And they were a little bit surprised to learn that we grow onions at, 4,500 foot elevation, and, they're at, 50 foot elevation. And so they were like, how did that happen? And I said, well, do you grow winters onions, plant them in the fall and grow them through the winter? I said, well, we try to do that. We have growers that are trying to do those types of things. But, the winters being so cold here, sometimes they're open, so we don't get snow on the ground. And snow is a great insulator, as everyone well knows. So we don't necessarily do it that way. So they had started planting already. Their early crop was just coming up. But when the weather is like that, you would expect that to be that way. So I said, those are the dissimilarities between our systems, but I understand what the onion is doing. So it, makes sense that you're doing that.
So it brings me to the freeze we just
had. Oh, yeah, right.
I think it actually froze in several areas of the state. So I guess not totally unprecedented, but I don't know if this happens every year in June.
Well, as the climate people say, in theory at elevation, something could happen every day that is quite dissimilar from the previous day. And so, yeah, this cold snap was a little maybe unusual, but I think if you went to the historic record, you would find that that is not an uncommon occurrence to have some kind of cold weather. And, to see it as hard of a freeze as it was, because I had one of my buddies from out in the middle of the valley here in Cache County that said, he had temperatures on his thermometer at 27 degrees. Mm. And so, that's pretty cold if you're starting to think about certain crops. Now, would I worry about lettuce? Would I worry about radish? Would I worry about spinach? Would I worry about cabbage and broccoli and those kinds of things at those temperatures? No. Those cooler weather crops are designed to kind of deal with that. What kind of hurts the plant more is the fact that it was pretty warm before it, and so they kind of get acclimated to the warm, and then all of a sudden that cold air comes on them, and that can kind of set them back a little bit. The ones that you really are kind of more concerned about are things like your melons and squashes, you know, your tomatoes and peppers and things like that. Anything that really likes warm weather. Your beans can be quite sensitive to it. So I did see some leaf drooping in mine, but I'd only had 36 or 37 at my house here in Logan. And so it wasn't nearly as cold, even though there was a little frost on the roof. So, yeah, now what happens at about 30 or 29 degrees then for these warm weather crops? Their cells aren't very elastic, and so they individual cells will start to freeze. And then when they thaw, that breaks the membrane that's in the cell, and then you'll get these little dark spots on it. So what you're going to probably see in cases is margins of leaves that might have a little bit of discoloration to them. They look water-soaked, maybe a darker color. And then eventually now as they start to warm up, that'll dry out, and you'll have this kind of blistered look on the leaf that can disturb you a little bit, but that's just a symptomology of if you had some freezing. You might even get chilling injury. We had a couple cold nights the night before and last night were both kind of cold, but they weren't really freezing. And all those things accumulate and cause damage to the plant. And so they're going to look like they're not going to be growing as rapidly. Things like basil, which is really sensitive to cold. Beans, pretty sensitive to cold. Tomatoes are pretty hardy in a way. They won't take 27, so there's going to be some damage on them if you were that cold. But I think for the most part, we kind of weathered it reasonably well. Just kind of look at your plants and don't overwater them. This is not a water problem. This is a temperature problem. Those are completely different things. And so people see, oh, they look a little wilty. I better water them. And then you just water them and water them and water them. Now you got a water-soaked environment for a plant that's under stress, and that's a secondary stress that they're going to have to cope with. So please don't do that. Just your normal watering pattern as it's been. If you've been watering once a week or something, maintain that schedule, and the weather's going to warm up again, and those plants will start to grow. And they never freeze all the way back down to the ground, so oftentimes those lateral buds, you'll start to see those break, and it'll delay things a little bit. That's always a concern for most people. I want early tomatoes. I want early peppers. I want early squash. Well, this is going to kind of thing that kind of slows that all up.
So by and large, probably if you see some of those signs, you're probably okay in most
places.
Yeah,
okay. You know, it's a question of degree. Mm-hmm. You have to, you know, I always look at it as, you know, how bad is the cut? Should I go get it stitched or should I just put a bandage on it? This is probably one of those bandaged moments. But if you're in some of the central parts of the valley, the lowest areas, you may see more damage because the temperature is going to get colder there. Cold air settles into those lower spots. Then if you really have some serious tomato damage or something like that, that may warrant replanting. But interestingly enough, what we've often seen is that the root system of those plants has been established and it's pretty good. If the stem is fairly green, you'll get lateral bud development and you'll get a nice bush and a nice plant out of it that'll fruit. The problem will be that if you were expecting your first tomatoes about the 1st of August, which most people expect around here, it may be more like the 15th or 20th of August. And if you plant those other ones right now, kind of, I'm going to have a late planting, those things probably aren't going to fruit and flower and do their thing until maybe September. And then we're at the back end of the growing season, and what happens in September? Well, we might see our first frost again, which is, you know, kind of the way we have to think about where we live, that we're at elevation and lots of things happen up here.
Makes it more exciting, I guess, right?
Yeah, well, and that's the beauty of it. I mean, I just remember in my years it would be these things, and I would just get a wave of emails asking me questions from people that lived in higher mountain valleys where the propensity for frost was much greater. So if you were in the the Wasatch back someplace, or if you were out Vernal Way, or, you know, if you were down Richfield or someplace, you know, those are the places that always kind of get that colder weather settling in. And if you're along the Wasatch Front, you know, it didn't get that cold. It got cold, and, you know, the weather people talk about, oh, it was pretty cold, you know, we set some new records. Yeah, well, you know, that, you know, records are meant to be broken, I always say. And so you're going to have some of these extremes on either end. And I would say that now the bigger issue will be, you know, we're supposed to warm up, and we always know that it gets hot in July, and we always know it's hot in August. So, you know, we have to start to kind of plan for that as well. And this is just an anomaly along the way.
If you just joined us, we're talking with Dan Drost, a gardening expert, and he's answering your questions, and so I hope you'll take advantage of this. You can get your question to us a couple of ways. First is email, upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com, that's upraccess@gmail.com, or you can call us to 800-826-1495, 800-826-1495, that's 800-826-1495. And Dan, we do have a question by email.
Okay.
This is from Michelle Welch. Hi, Michelle. She says, we had a biblical infestation of grasshoppers last year. I'm assuming their eggs are in my soil. What can I do now to stop them? I can't find the heavy-duty killer anywhere, and would also like to know what to use and whether I can start using it now, or do I have to wait for some sign? I enjoy listening to your shorts. They're very helpful. Thank you. So, that's
Michelle, I know what you're talking about. Yeah, we had that last year. There were lots of grasshoppers. We're on the uptick, so to speak, in terms of kind of this cyclical pattern. The Extension Service has a really good bulletin on it. So go to USU. .edu and look for Extension, and then under Extension, go to the Pest and Disease Management site. And in that, they've put together a publication on grasshoppers, and in that publication will be a list of everything that you can possibly use to kind of control them. Now, there are some compounds. I don't give those kind of recommendations over the phone, so to speak. I would probably if I talked to you individually, but over the radio, I usually don't do that because I'm not going to advocate for one thing over another because we have a wide range of audience that's listening. So look in that. There are organic options. Yes, I did see that a lot of the compounds that normally are being used in the garden centers are burning through their stocks pretty fast because people are having this problem. Thankfully, I had product in my garage yet that was from last year when I had the grasshopper problem, so I was able to take care of it. But then my sister-in-law heard that I was taking care of, so then I had to go spray her yard. And then my friend heard that I was doing that, and so I had to loan them my sprayer. Then I had an email this morning from a friend who said I need to buy something because my yard is running over. And so I just said, well, I didn't have any product, and this is what you want to look for. But that bulletin has all of that. So they have different types of materials, and there's a lot of different things that you can use. The critical thing is that you should treat it when they're little. You know, so if you see those hoppers and they're only a quarter to a half inch long or something like that, when you look at them, then you can get them. Once they get up about a half inch long or bigger, they are almost immune to most everything. Their bodies are able to withstand it. So when they're in those early stages of development, that's the best time to do it. And so if you have a grasshopper problem, go out, talk to your garden center people or so, get that compound. But more importantly, I would say go to the Extension website and look at that bulletin, download it, and then it will tell you things that you can do because the entomologists up on campus have put that together to help solve this problem because they can't afford to have, you know, everybody in the state calling them either. And so these are ways to outreach. And as I said, there's a long list of materials that are available to do that.
So thanks for that, Michelle. Tell us where to get that bulletin again.
Yeah, go to www.usu.edu. So that'll get you to the university. Then on the top bar of that, you'll see a sign for Extension. It's usually way over on the right side. And then once you're in Extension's website, you can go to the pest management page, or you can go an easy way is in your browser, just go Grasshopper Control Utah State University, and usually that will jump you straight to the bulletin. And you don't want to really look at other university stuff because this is designed and specific for our own area, and that's sometimes important. And the chemicals that are there are things that you should be able to find locally. And then treat it, like I said, don't wait and let those little hoppers get too big, because once they're bigger, then they kind of look back at you and kind of smile and say, I'm going to eat your garden. And they do.
So if they get big, you just have to wait to the next cycle? Is that?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, there really aren't good ways to control big grasshoppers. You know, mm-hmm. the bulletin actually talks about that, too. Okay. So, I mean, what I do is, you know, when they get a little bit larger, I go around the yard and kind of grab them and put them in a bucket and kill them that way. Just simply because big ones do an awful lot of damage. So I kind of watch for them. But my yard is pretty much free of it because I treated last week. And so it makes a big difference to treat. And they'll probably be bad again next year, because we got a big population, and then the cycle kind of changes, and so there's a high cycle, and we're in the high zone now, so a lot of hoppers around, and then in a few, 2 or 3 years, they're going to go down and down, and then you don't see them for a while, and this is just a normal insect pattern, just like the large cicada outbreak back east, you know. Talking to family, they just said it's deafening, the noise that these critters can make, you know, for a couple of weeks, you know, when you have a huge hatch like that. And the same with hoppers, they're just going to do an awful lot of damage.
All right, hopefully that helps, Michelle. Appreciate that. And you can get your question in for Dan as well to 800-826-1495, 800-826-1495, a call from anywhere, or email us to upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back with Dan Drost answering your gardening questions. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking gardening today. Many of us grow a garden. Maybe you participate in the community garden. You have a big backyard garden. Some people have a box next to the window, Dan.
That's right.
So we've got a gardening expert, Dan Drost, with us to answer your gardening questions. And you can get your question to us right now by email to upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com. Once again, upraccess@gmail.com, or you can call us to 800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Once again, 800-826-1495, your gardening question to gardening expert Dan Drost. So, Dan, we talked about freezing.
Yep.
Maybe we can go to the extreme. It's going to get hot again.
Yep.
How do you deal with extreme heat?
Well, you know, plants over time begin to adapt to it. But one needs to remember that certain plants don't like it super hot. And so our cool weather crops, things like your peas, things like cabbage and broccoli, you know, they'll start to look a little funny when the heat really comes on. And so what are ways to deal with it in lettuce, or try to extend your lettuce production season into the summer? Is trying to reduce the heat load on the plant. Now, I can't do anything about the temperature. The temperature is what the temperature is, but I can do something about reducing heat load on the plant itself. And so for some of those cooler weather crops at this time of the year, I recommend that you often try to plant things in zones in your garden. So plant the cool season stuff together, plant the warm season stuff together, because when the heat comes on for the cool weather crops and you want to continue that lettuce, I'm still picking lettuce right now, but I've got it in an area that kind of maintains itself to be a little bit cooler in my garden. The other thing that I end up doing is building some shade over top of it. Now, we're going to use shade at this time of the year to just cut back on the heat load. It doesn't change the air temperature any, but it does reduce it. It's like standing under a shade tree when it's a hot day. It's just a little bit less pressure on the system. And so that's the way it is going to be for those plants as well. And that will extend the pea harvest. That'll extend the lettuce. It'll keep the spinach going for a couple more weeks. It'll help with the radishes, all of those types of crops. And then when it gets late July and early August, when it's super hot again, I move that shade over into my warm weather crops like my tomatoes and my eggplants and my peppers so that I reduce the heat load on those guys so that fruit sizing continues, so that we don't get blemishes on the fruit when they're exposed to the sunlight. You know, you'll often see thing, and you'll have a lot less blossom end rot, all of those kinds of things which are heat related that you want to avoid. So having some shade cloth is a really good thing to have. And once you purchase it, you just need to put a couple stakes in, clip it to it, and it just kind of sits there in the garden giving you exactly what an umbrella would do or exactly what sitting under the tree will do. It'll keep those plants a little bit cooler and make them more fruitful and more productive. And so that's really what we want. The big problem, you know, is like, okay, I never get quite enough tomatoes from my garden. Well, this way you'll get more tomatoes because they do grow bigger and more of them will set and fewer of them will have blemishes. And I use the ones that even have blemishes, but we don't often like that to do that. And so we kind of get around it by putting some shade up. And so I'm going to be dealing with heat that way. The second thing you're going to deal with is kind of watch your watering a little bit more. So oftentimes, you know, we have it set on our sprinkler and our sprinkler might go 15 minutes. Well, in fact, we're not deep watering when we water for 15 minutes. 15 minutes is enough to deep water for grass because the root system on a grass plant is only maybe in the first 4 to 6 inches. Well, in our garden, most of our vegetables are down to 12 or 14 or 16 inches deep, and so I have to be able to deep water. So you need to be able to do that. Having it on your sprinkler system is not always the best way to do it, and so I always supplement some water. Yeah, it's easier for me in my yard to have it that way because my system is set up for grass, but what I do is just move some hoses and then run some extra water once a week, a deep, larger amount of water to try and push that water deeper into the profile so that those plants are under less stress as well. And why you see them under stress mostly is because we're just going to use our sprinkler system that's only running for 2 or 3 times a week for 15 or 20 minutes, which isn't really that much water when you go out and measure it. Okay, so they're going to need about 1.5 to 2 inches of water. A garden is a week, and you got to figure out how much that is. And so put a tuna fish can or a catch cup or something like that out into your garden area to see how much water is actually going on. And then you go, oh, it's a 1/3 of an inch 3 times. Well, that's 1 inch. But if I need 1.5 to 2 inches, I'm really shorting it, so I need to supplement it somehow. And then the hose can do that with a sprinkler head or a whatever. And so we got to watch the watering throughout the summer, and when the heat comes, that will help alleviate it along with the shade. And so those two things really can change the dynamics of a garden and make them much, much more productive.
I have a question. This is from a friend of mine. I was talking last night with him, in fact. Got to talking about gardening, and he usually puts in a garden, but hasn't this year because he's been doing a lot of traveling.
Yep.
Now he's back. And the question came up, you gonna do it now? I don't know what he's decided, but I'll put that to you. Can you plant a garden this late?
Well, yes and no. I'm gonna I'll give you the yes first, and then I'll give you the no second. Okay, the yes part is yes, you can, but it comes with some caveats, and that's going to be the no part. So, yeah, there are a lot of things that you can do, and what you really are looking for now is for crops that mature relatively fast. So the types of things that mature relatively fast are things like your summer squashes and your zucchinis. You know, it takes them about a month to get up to size, and then they start flowering, and you have a lot of product, you know. So by mid-July, late July, you're going to have lots of zucchinis and crooknecks and other, you know, of those fresh-type squashes that we eat. But if you try to plant something like a pumpkin or a winter squash this late in the season, oftentimes the fruit takes so long to mature that the fruit is still green when you're picking it in September, and it really doesn't taste very good. So no, on those crops. Things like watermelon and cantaloupe, another one that takes an awful long time, so I would say no for those. But there's a lot of things like beans, bush beans in particular. They're about a 50-day crop to a 60-day crop, so when you plant them, I sequentially plant those. So my first ones went in, maybe the 20th of May, or maybe before that, the 1st of May. Yeah, thinking back, the 1st of May, they were up about the 15th of May. Then about the 1st of June, I planted another crop, and then I'll plant another one about the 1st of July, and that gives me like three nice crops of beans that I pick over a two and a half week, three week period, and I have almost a continuous supply. I don't plant them once. I plant smaller patches multiple times. So beans are a good one that you can do. Some of the peppers, some of the early tomatoes, you can still get some fruits on. If you're really interested in colored pepper fruits, those take a lot longer, so that's not an option maybe for you. But the green ones, yeah, you can do that, you know, just fine. Watch your tomatoes. Some of them get really big and they fruit over a very long period, so you want dwarf types or you want compact types, what we call determinate types of tomatoes. They set fruit really early and they're not nearly as productive, but you could still do something like that. And then once it gets into middle of July or something, I really start seeding things like lettuce and spinach and those kinds of things because I want to start harvesting those in September when it's cooler again. And I can harvest those in September and October. And if I do a little bit of protection, I might even get them into about the first week of November. And so you got those types of options for you as well, the cool weather crops, but they're really fast maturing types. I would not probably plant cabbage this late. You've got to plant that earlier, and it takes a long time to mature, but you can find some short maturing broccoli that could work for you. So there are many, many options, and there are publications, again, on the Extension website. All the vegetables are there. You can kind of go in and do a little bit of researching it, but always looking for short time production windows that from planting to harvest is relatively a short number rather than a big number. And then you're going to be okay. So yes for some, no for others. And then kind of knowing where you live, too, makes a big difference. And if you have some more protection. So I know some people are starting to put up small little tunnel houses or they build little cloches out in their gardens to extend the season. Yeah, then anytime you do that, then you have the you're adding in something that is missing, and what usually starts to become missing in late September and October is warmth. And so you're creating a warmer environment to try and extend that. And then you can maybe get by with some of the intermediate length of maturity crops.
Oh, interesting. So he could plant some.
He can plant there's some. A lot of options for him to be planting. It's just just thinking about it a little bit, but then going in and looking at some of the publications that we have available and saying to yourself, well, okay, it takes 50 days. Where is 50 days from today? That's right. What I need to think about. Where is 100 days from today? 100 days to maturity means I'm into late October, and that may not work for me, particularly if it's a warm weather crop.
Right. Well, let's take another break. We'll come back with the final segment with Dan Drost. The time goes by quickly, and hope you'll get your question in. So a couple of ways to do that. You can email us to upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com, or call us to 800-826-1495, 800-826-1495. Gardening expert Dan Drost is with us answering your gardening questions. upraccess@gmail.com or 800-826-1495. We'll have more following this. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking gardening today. Many of us are gardeners, and you know, you might have just a little box near your window, or maybe you've got a large backyard garden.
Here's a chance to pick the brain of our gardening expert, Dan Drost. You can get a question to us right now to upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com, or you can call us to 800-826-1495, 800-826-1495. I thought that example, I do have a couple friends who garden on a very, very small scale. So a little box.
Yeah.
What would your suggestion be for someone doing that or considering that?
Well, you know, the key thing is that the container that you're growing in, if it's a box or a bucket or whatever, should be large enough. So think about how big the top of the plant grows. That's about how much area you need in the root. So, you know, I've seen a lot of people garden in 5-gallon bucket equivalents, you know, a big pot or something like that. Generally, don't overplant in it, so one or two plants maximum. But I grow, like all my basil, I always grow in pots. And I seed it pretty early. I like it above ground because it keeps the roots really warm during the day, and the basil seems to like that, and it's extremely prolific. So that's key. Second thing that you need to think about, so a big enough root box. Second thing you need to know is watering it needs to be frequent. So oftentimes I'll put mine on a timer so that it gets watered maybe once or twice a day for a short period of time. I kind of work out what that is. You're going to kind of see how much that's going to take. If you're doing it with a hose wand, every day it needs to have a good soaking, and I generally do it in the evening, but you could do it in the morning. It doesn't matter. Third thing is you need to continuously feed. None of the potting mixes that we use or we're going to put into a container have very low nutrient content, so you need to find yourself a good, complete, soluble fertilizer. Once again, that will then help feed the plant and keep it growing vigorously. Too often we see people don't feed them, and then they aren't very productive. And so I feed mine weekly. And when they're really growing vigorously, I might feed them twice a week. And so just get another container of that soluble fertilizer, and then it'll tell you on the label exactly what the nutrient content is. It'll tell you how to make the solution up, and then it'll also tell you how much to put in it. And so by watering it regularly, by feeding it weekly, by having a big enough root space for the plant, one can get an abundance of tomatoes. So you really need a bucket for a tomato, a bucket for some peppers, if you're going to grow some basil. And, oh, what do I have if I have tomatoes and peppers and basil? I have almost all the things that I need for making a salsa or something like that. Mm. You know, and so you can do it, yeah. And it doesn't take that much. And actually, if you think about it and look at it, you know, the plants are reasonably attractive anyway. And so you can just kind of intersperse them into your on your patio or something along with whatever flowers. Don't overseed them. Lots of people like to put flowers in with them. You know, then you got competition. You got all these things working against it. You know, it just takes, it's more management. A single plant, a single tomato plant in a bucket does just fine. Hmm. And that can be your little garden. And then later in the fall, you might have some other ones where you have some lettuce or some radishes or something like that in those pots. You could do carrots. You can do all of these things in small containers if all you have is a little patio that's outside your granny flat, as I'm used to calling it, you know, your retirement place on the backyard. You want to have a little something and do that because the homeowners association may say, well, you can't dig up the yard and you can't do this, but you could do that. And so you can get quite a bit of nice stuff in it. And as I said, it's movable too. You can put it on wheels. So if you had this cold weather the other day, what would I recommend doing? Having it in a place where I can pull it up right next to the house. I could push it in the garage. I could put it someplace where it's not going to be impacted by that. And so from that perspective, yeah, it's much, much more protective, and it allows you to do much, much more stuff if you have it in containers.
Let's talk a bit about fruit. I mean, you know, some people have trees in their yard or whatever it is. What should we consider there?
Well, Well, I just finished thinning my peaches this morning. Peaches were about the size of a quarter. If you look at them around, it's, you know, peach thinning time. When I looked at the tree earlier this year, it was like, oh, I don't think I've got that many peaches on it. I had a third of a buck of peaches that I pulled off the tree, and people freak out when you think about that. But if I don't thin, what happens? Fruit size is really small, and so they'll only get, you know, the size of a golf ball or slightly larger than that if you don't thin. Now I'm going to have peaches that are bigger than a baseball, you know, which is about the right size that I want. And so on a branch that's maybe 12 inches long, you would want about two peaches on that branch. And so if you have more than that, if the branch is 6 inches, maybe one. If it's 18 inches, maybe three. And they should be spaced out about 6 or 8 inches apart. So when you're thinking about thinning, don't leave them all in a cluster. Space them out a little bit on that. And don't be afraid to thin too hard, because the tree has to produce the energy for those fruits. And we really don't want, unless you want really small peaches, you know, then leave them thicker. I like peach that's maybe the size of a baseball or maybe up to a softball size. And if you thin too hard, then they're going to even get bigger than that. So it just kind of depends on what you want. So peach thinning is a thing to do. It's also apple thinning time. So you need to be thinking about that. I had some natural thinning that went on earlier this year. The deer that live in my neighborhood came through, and right about flower time they came through and they nipped off almost all of them. Mm. I have an espalier tree because my yard is relatively small, and it was going to have a beautiful crop of apples. And the next morning one comes outside and you can see where they just chewed off the tips of all of the apples. So I think I got 4 or 5 apples this year. So it's so like, these are the things that go on. You would say, why are the deer in town? Well, it's a nice place to live too. You know, they mm-hmm, like, there's mm-hmm. plenty of fun places for them to run around. And we have a resident herd that lives over by the temple where I live, and they're on the side hill there, as you might imagine. And they come into the yard. So I didn't have to do much apple thinning this year. And then I got an apricot tree in my yard. I never thin it because I really don't want the apricots to be too big. I might thin maybe 10% of the tree or less, you know, because there are some that I want eating apricots. And the rest of them I just want for canning or for jam. I love apricot jam. So I could have apricot jam on my English muffin every morning because it is so good. And so I don't really care about size. I just need to have fruit. And it's prolific this year, so I'll have smaller fruit, but I can live with that. What I'll do here, now that the fruit have set their nut and are getting up to the size, that point where I'll start supplementing some water. I fertilized them a couple weeks ago pretty heavily, so I'm seeing a lot of vigor. So I got a lot of new shoot growth, which is next year's crop. That's where it will come, and I'm in pretty good shape with that. Pears, not much you probably have to do at this time. Once again, look on the Extension website if you need some really specific things. I generally don't spray my fruit trees very much, and so I'm not too worried about that. The only one I usually do is if I'm looking for coddling moth, because I do get that, and I want to have coddling moth-free, worm-free apples, so to speak. But I don't have any apples this year, so I'm like, I'm not going to worry about it too much, you know. But the Extension website has stuff on fruit tree production. You can go to that site. Everything you need to know about how to garden is on www.usu.edu/extension. And then there's a gardening page on that. Tells you all the things that are happening. Things that are coming up that are important is garlic time, as it's getting close to garlic harvest time, usually by the end of July or the end of June, early July, the tops start to begin to yellow. We don't want to let them get completely yellow, because then the clove and the skin that sits around the onion bulb or the garlic bulb cloves starts to break open and it doesn't store nearly as well. So you want to pull those up early and then just hang them to dry completely, and then you have a nice clove that's really got tight skin on it, and it'll preserve itself. So that's happening. That's a critical thing to do. If you've direct seeded your onions, now's the time to really start to thin them to get them out to the final spacing. If you transplanted them, there's nothing you need to do. Just let them grow. You'll have nice onions a little bit later in the year. So that's it. Think about continuous seeding on things like beans. If you want some late squash, you know, maybe plant some more zucchinis. Because mine are in about the 6-leaf stage or 7-leaf stage. I can see some early flowers, but I might want some for September, and these guys will start to fade out as the season progresses just from all producing all those fruits, and so I might seed a few extra of that. My Brussels sprouts are about 3 feet tall right now in my garden. Mm-hmm. I'm really excited about that because last year I didn't have any Brussels sprouts in the yard, so this year I found some and I planted them, and they're I just got to continuously feed those, or so I'll be putting some extra nitrogen on those, and usually it's about the equivalent of a half a tablespoon for every two plants, and I sprinkle that around just before I irrigate so that it washes it in the soil, and that'll help keep them growing. My cabbages are heading right now, so I'm looking like mid-July I might get some fresh coleslaw out of the garden, which is always exciting. So I can think about, my sister-in-law owes me a rack of ribs. She said, you know, that was my Christmas present. Yeah, I'm going to give you a rack of ribs. So I'm going to call her up, and I got to cook them. She doesn't even cook them for me. So shout out to her. But I get the rack. So so I'll have some ribs, and I'll make some coleslaw and make some beans and have myself and a couple beer. It's good. Life is good. It's July, right? That's what we're supposed to do. It's July. Let's enjoy it.
Well, Deb, just have about 30 seconds left. I want to get this question in.
Sure.
I guess John of St. George, I think he's responding to your deer problem. He asks, what are some deer-resistant plants to put around your veggies?
You know, I know a couple gardeners up here. What they do is, next time you get your hair cut, get some hair from the barber.
Oh.
Okay. And just sprinkle that around the periphery of your veggie garden. I do know someone that also uses urine. I don't necessarily recommend that because it's a little messy, but if those are scent cues that cause the deer to stay away, and hair is a good one to do. You can just make little sachets of it and just kind of hang it in places, you know, and so you can go to the barber and get that. They generally have lots of hair. That's what a barber does, right? And then there aren't really that many kind of plants that I know of you can get the deer to stay away from, because they still like to go into the garden. And so I always, like my cabbage and broccoli this year, I put fencing around it to keep the deer away from it so that they just couldn't get to it. And then they would go someplace else. So you have to do that, just something to obstruct them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's try to fit one more question in.
Sure.
30 Quick. Seconds on this. I'll just read this. I live in a very arid part of Utah. For about 75 years, my yard was watered every 2 weeks from irrigation water. Some parts of the lawn would have 4 inches of water. I have very large trees on one edge of the lawn. The lawn's about 100 feet by 60 feet, very dry with dandelions and wild rose starts coming up. However, my city unfortunately decided to discontinue the irrigation water 2 years ago. I've tried to water with sprinklers, but it's impossible to move one sprinkler around as a substitution. Arg, says the person. the perennial flowers are in deep distress and no longer bloom. An apricot tree is dying, but it was pretty old.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sad, says the writer. And is there a system that I could use, they ask. I don't have money to put in a sprinkler system, so I've been dragging hoses. Is there a system they could use for this?
Yeah, I'll tell you something my grandpa used to do. He lived in the city, and he took some 6-inch PVC pipe, or something the equivalent of that, and then he took his post hole digger and just made a big hole down into the ground, deep into the ground, and then he would just fill that hole with water inside the tube, and had some drilled holes in it so that it could spread out from there. That gets it deep down in the soil. Certainly do that around the trees that you want to save. I don't know about saving all the wildflowers. Then you start to go to your extension person and research what are some of the wildflowers that are the desert plants that you can have? And there are new plants that you can probably self-seed into that to solve that problem. But I would do some tubes. You can fill those tubes really fast with a hose. It's better than sprinkling. It gets water really deep into the soil, and you'll solve your problem, certainly, and save your trees, the trees that you want to save.
All right, so hopefully that's a
quick and dirty 30-second approach, yeah.
Yeah, yeah,
but
appreciate
use your
that.
Extension service.
Yeah, extension service, right, yeah.
Go to them, that local county. They'll help you.
That's very good service and very good advice for anybody, right?
Yes.
Wherever you are, you've got an extension office. Well, Dan Dross, has been a pleasure as always. Thank you so much. Any fun stuff coming up? Another trip to somewhere?
Yeah, we're going to Michigan and Wisconsin. We're going to sit by a lake and fish, and we're going to go see one of my nephews get married. And so that will be the last of the weddings, I think, in the Drost family. So thank goodness for that. That means no more trips back east unless I want to go there. So
Right. Yeah. There's a difference. Want to go or
wanna,
have to
go. Yeah.
Very good. Well, it sounds like you're enjoying your retirement. We appreciate you helping us out here.
Happy to do it, Tom.
Access Utah. We'll have you on again here shortly. Dan Dross, gardening expert, UPR friend, has been answering your gardening questions. Keep those questions coming to upraxcess@gmail.com. We can pass those on to Dan. And thanks for listening, everybody, to Access Utah.